Today is June 24, 1988, and I'm here with Hiram Jenkins, close to his barbecue in Jacksonville, Florida. And we're going to be talking about his barbecue business a little bit. Okay, first of all, I need your full name. First, middle, and last.
First, middle, and last. Hiram is the first name. Middle is Theodore. And the last is Jenkins.
And spelling for Jenkins?
J-E-N-K-I-N-S.
Okay. And you're a junior, right?
Hello.
Okay. And we need your address. That's fine. Thank you very much.
Address 2323 Orange Pickle Road, Mandarin, Florida.
Okay. And the zip code for Mandarin?
32223.
Okay. And we need your date of birth and your birthplace.
Okay. 41358 Mandarin.
Okay.
Born at home.
Okay. And you've lived in this area all your life then? Okay. And your occupation?
I'm a cook.
Okay.
I'm a small business owner.
Okay. You own the barbecue, right? And marital status?
2 years married.
Okay. All right. And let's see. I'm interested in how you got started with the barbecue.
Well, I guess it wasn't a forced issue, but more so forced than anything because I was an adolescent and living at home. And it was a thing that my daddy was doing, so quite naturally I would be involved with it. I did take, in the school, I took all the college preparatory courses in Cooks 1 and 2, and Foods 1 and 2 was a couple of the preparatory courses that they give you in school, preparing for college. So by that, I did take an interest in food, and I grew to like it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's come easy, you know. Because I'm not pressed too much so far as, you know, hustle and bustle of doing the same old rigmarole every day. I don't have to go through that. It's a change and it's a different atmosphere on a daily basis. There's customers coming in and out, and then you're doing parties and caterings and all kind of gatherings. Excuse me. So it don't stagnate one, you know, so much.
And what high school did you graduate from?
Wilson.
Wilson, okay. All right. That's right down here in the Mandarin area, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Powell's Avenue.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So a lot of the business you just kind of learned from your father as you were growing up with it, right?
All except the, I think most of the field work, meaning the storefront openings, caterings and different types, I think it was more of a trial and error thing than anything.
Oh, okay.
A lot of times you get out on the job site and you have to go with what you got. For instance, someone might come and they got a potted dish or something, or you don't want it served out of their dish, so you try to, you know, range yourself where you can do it, so you use what you got.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I say, when you're preparing the coleslaw, potato salad, or beans or something like that. Well, coleslaw, it'll need a pan on the bottom with ice in it to maintain the temperature, keep it cool or chill. Well, it's vice versa with the beans. You need water in it and some kind of canned heat to maintain the temperature there. So a lot of times we're coming right off the pit with it and it's piping hot. We're just going just one pan and serve it, rather than have the water up on it to maintain the temperature, because it's being used then. Mm-hmm. And I'll use my thermometer, or I'll use just my hand, or just sight, mm-hmm. to tell when the temperature's dropped too low. And I can always pull it from the line, or use my pit, you know, so to bring the temperature up. You know, so.
That's something that you kind of learn with on-the-job
right.
training, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
And
yeah.
then a lot of times, you know, you'll be on a particular area where one don't want you to do it the way you're accustomed to doing it.
Uh-huh.
And they'll ask, you know, can you do it this way? Or would you mind if you do it this way?
Uh-huh.
I like it done that way. I did a wedding last Saturday on the 19th. It was out of over at the Riverwalk. Well, you know that fountain is over. They wanted me to use the space just on the concrete. They didn't want me on the grass. So that being around, the conference of that fountain, it hindered me from setting up a line or buffet like I would have had it not been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself setting up the dining area in a box shape, and leaving just enough space for them to walk inside for the inside seats, and the outside they can just walk around it.
Yeah.
It looked good, and they were, everybody was happy.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't how I would have set it. You know, I might have used, you know, angle to set three tables this way, or I might have set them all, you know, one behind each other. I might have just made one long line, you know, but I had never set up quite like that before. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned to you one time we cooked 7,000-9,000 chicken one time. We had two lines, but it didn't take nothing but a little common sense to set it up. And as we were setting it up, we must have changed two or three times in the midst of setting it up. And the reason being is because it was going to be so congested with people coming from two different directions headed at each other. There was no turning point. So that's where that angle part came from. That's where I learned that right there. I said, well, if you set it from an angle, people start back this way. When they come out, they're already at the end. It already creates a turn for them, you know, because you had an angle. When they come at the end of that table, that's it. They just walk on out. They're already in the dining area. So that was a trick that I learned. And another trial and error thing was an octagon. We had to set up an octagon line where we had one, two, three lines going at the same time. Mm-hmm. That was at a NES.
What's NES?
NES Jacks.
Oh, okay.
17.
Oh, yeah.
They did a party for the rework facility. It was a bunch of people, 800 or 900 of them out there at least.
Wow.
And they only had a half hour to eat, so that was the drawing card to get three lines set up rather than two. Two was set up, thousands of people can eat off of two lines. When you get with it, you got a time element involved. You got to set up more lines. It takes more catering supplies, more pans, more racks, more sterno can heater, whatever kind you're using. It takes more manpower. It takes everything more, but you get it done quicker. So the time element, time is money. So you save time, you save money. You know, you can use the same amount of people to back up three lines as you can two.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to work faster.
Yeah.
You know, be checking things more often.
Yeah. Your business has kind of an interesting history because it goes way back to, was it your great grandfather, or your grandfather?
Great grandfather.
And then it's kind of evolved over time from like a street corner type thing and just getting together for parties into your takeout service and that. Can you tell me how your great grandfather got started with it and give me kind of an overview of that history?
My great grandfather. I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, but my great grandfather was hard headed. Just about like my father was, is my great grandfather was a carbon copy. My great grandfather, once he got something to work, he didn't want to change it. And he wouldn't try. I mean, he wouldn't give an effort. If you say, well, this worked just as good as that, he wouldn't hear from it. Do it my way. That's the way he wanted done. He used to dig a hole in the ground and take an old bed spring. You've seen them before, kind of interlink. And he'd take an old bed spring. And in those days, it was not too much ribs and chicken cooked, but just pork meat, half of a cow, a whole hog, a shoulder, a butt, or something like that. And he would dig that hole, and he'd build him a good hot fire, I mean real hot, 600 or 700 degrees, and he let all the wood burn to coals. Then he'd chip the wood apart and make coals out of it. I'm talking about actual coals that'd be emerald. And he would put that hog on there, and he would leave it. Go back, it's done. Never had to pierce it or nothing like that. Well, from that, I can't remember exactly whether it was the weather condition, sand, or what, that caused him to start putting the 55-gallon drum, or half a drum, cut it all the way open, put it over the hog to maintain freshness and keep it away from lice or rodents or any kind like that. I can't remember exactly what happened to cause that. But I do remember is that is what happened to make a start with the pitch. The 55-gallon drum cooked the hog so tender until he said, well, shoot, I don't see why we don't just build something, you know, a little better. The first pit that we actually built, it was made out of galvanized material. It was galvanized on the outside, and it was overlaid with aluminum on the inside. Because you can't use galvanized. You can't use it. It's solid.
Why not?
When it heats up, it's some kind of a toxic gas comes out of the pores of the galvanized, and it causes disease of some kind. So they can't use that. And the first pit that we built, to the best that I can give you a description of it, it looks like a flue from like a chimney top. That's exactly how it was built, just like a flue with the round part on the top, the two little ends where it come out, and the front was two doors that was in tracks that slid back and forth. Now, that wasn't a whole pit. What that was a top, and that whole thing, it fit over top of the grill, the great part of the grill. And then on the bottom of it was all blocks, a few bricks to hold up some tin to keep the wind from blowing in the fire and changing the temperature to any great degree. And it wasn't mobile. Matter of fact, depending on the weather, we had to move it from a sun spot to a cool spot on the oak tree here and there, and we moved it all around. And even back when it was building the community center, we was donating time and effort. And we took that pit out there, and that's where it rotted out. That's where it finally went to bad. Cooking every Saturday out there, leaving it in the rain, nobody would cover it like we used to do. No one would come take care of it. And it finally rotted out. And we did finally get it back to the house there. It wasn't nothing to bring, really. It was just something to throw away, you know.
What community center was that, by the way?
The Harriet Beecher Stowe Community Center, right up here on Orange Pickens in San Jose.
So you were doing barbecues for them pretty regularly?
My father, after we built our house, he had a bunch of blocks and, you know, raw material left over. So he donated all that to the center, and his time and also my own. He volunteered my time, too. And we would go up there, and every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we would cook. And during those days, you know, church, well, black churches in particular, would sell chitlin dinners with collard greens and regular white rice. Those were collard greens good too. And they would serve those dinners, and they were so cheap. I mean, $3.50, you get more than two people to eat. And they was making a mint up there, and they built that center. And that rotted the pit out. Well, even before we started negotiating about getting the raw materials to build on these pits, I mean, we was talking about it, but no one had said nothing about it. But this guy came to my daddy, he was a friend of his, and he told me, he said, "You know what, Hiram?" He said, "I know what you can get to build your nice pit out. It won't ever wear out." He said, "What is that?" He said, "You need to get you one of them old diesel drums or kerosene drums or something that's big and heavy." He said, "If you go around right now," he said, "you see filling stations, they're changing them out to fiberglass." He said, "You can get one of those drums." He said, "Those guys want to get rid of them so bad, they'll just about haul it where you want to." Well, the drum didn't cost that much. $50 probably at most, the first drum cost. And we built it with in mind that we was going to do all the cooking on it. We built an oven in it. We put a water tank on it. We put drafting doors on either end. And we left the bottom open where you could load stock in it up to 8-10 foot easy. I mean, depending on the size of it, you can load it. And from that, trial and error, because we marked it off with chalk 10 times before we decided, well, that's the one we want. We marked off doors, different sizes. We marked off different fire boxes on it. We marked off everything, and we always come back and erase it. That ain't it. That ain't it. That ain't it. Until we finally got all of us coming, you know, to terms on it. We put all our heads together, and we came up with the first pit. And the oven, even right now, you can bake a potato pie in that oven on the pit better than you can in the oven that's inside. And that's a good stove inside. So it'll maintain a constant temperature, and it won't change on you like to any degree. I'm talking about quickly. You know, like say if it was to start raining and you out in the field, the temperature wouldn't fall 40 to 60 degrees like it would if you ran out of gas in the stove. It'd burn even, you know, so therefore you got an even product. Never have to turn your pies, never have to turn bread pudding when you put it in there. I've had the gatherings where I cooked oysters in the oven. I've boiled shrimp in that oven. Like I said, potato pies and bread pudding I cook in that oven. You cook anything, you can bake anything in that oven. Quiche, whatever. You know, you can boil, you can bake, you can do everything, and I cook rice in the oven. You know, and the reason we used to cook the rice in the oven in those days because Daddy was afraid that if we cooked it on the pit, the smoke won't go in it. Well, that's another thing I learned. I modified that technique where I can cook on the open pit itself. I can use pots, pans, and anything right on the open pit. It smokes it up bad, but the end result of the product that you're cooking is, I mean, it's beyond compare. it's the rice come out of the oven is a different rice than come off of that stove. Mm. It's a softer texture. It's a fluffier rice, and each grain is its own. Mm. And it don't have to be no Uncle Ben. Mm. It can be cracked rice. It all come off the same. Mm. So that is.
Is that a trade secret how you did it, or can you tell?
Yeah. It's the first thing, the most important part, is to remove the bones from the chicken. The bones in the chicken, it does two things to the rice. First thing, one might consume some of the rice and choke on the bone. You don't want that in business. And another thing, the bone, it hinders you from keeping a constant temperature. Because not only you have to heat the whole pot, you got to heat extra hot to get that bone to boil while it's in there. So no sooner than that chicken boil till it's tenders, you debone it, take everything off that you don't like yourself. I'm saying, because different cooks cook different ways. Some might leave the skin of the chicken in the pot of rice. Some might not. I'm one that might not. If I do, I disguise the skin of that chicken to such a way that you will never see it. I'll mince it. I mean, I'll chop it so fine that you will never see it. And just the skin of that chicken, when the rice come back to a boil, it'll just boil itself down to nothing but just a grease. And that's your oil that's in the pot. It's no vegetable oil in there, no additives that's in the rice that's not natural. It's all came from
that
chicken itself. Uh-huh. We take the fat of the chicken, and we boil it all separate until the grease of that fat is clear, just like vegetable oil that you get out of the store. And we add that back to the rice. Now, that's what you call a stock. When you get your stock ready, you can take and put it in a thin pan or thick pan and put it back on that pit. And as soon as it come to a boil, you pour your rice in there and then just move it from a direct heat over maybe 5 or 6 foot on that pit. And it's just like changing the temperature on your stove from a high temperature to a medium low.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
So it'll finish that rice off, and it's just as fluffy. And the complexion of it is pretty. I mean, it'd be something that you please with, you know, that you did it like that.
Yeah. That's called the perlo rice, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's a perlo. Some call it meat and rice. Some call it chicken and rice, depending on what kind of meat in. Sometimes we put, depending on the season, because 4th of July right now, chicken prices are up 65 cents a pound. My price, that's wholesale. That's coming from Drapers or Paramount or any of these guys that got millions of chicken.
Yeah.
So when meat prices go up like that, a lot of time we'll change the meat that's in the rice. For instance, sausage is cheaper than chicken. We might make sausage and rice. Or we might make shrimps and rice. Or it might be pork and rice. But whatever, there's some kind of meat is in that rice every day. Mm-hmm. And we try to cook it fresh every day. Now, there's times that we have a gathering of a substantial amount of people, 400 or 500 people, and there'll be some leftover. Now, if that's been properly maintained, and it's been cooked properly, you can bring the temperature back up on it, and it's just like fresh. I mean, a cook maybe could tell the difference if he asked, and he'd be looking for hints from you to give in, you know. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the appearance of the rice is the exact same, the complexion of it is the same, the texture, everything is the same. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you can use that product. But if it's anything less than that, then we just boop. In the can.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't use it. Can you? We try not to give, you know, I don't give nobody nothing that I would eat myself. If there's any doubt about anything that's being served out of there, don't use it. If you got to ask a second opinion on it, don't use it. If you come in there and you say, is this meat done? Don't use it. Because you already excited your customer because they look right over the counter and they can see you. And you're doing everything. You're making a movie every day. I mean, everybody can see exactly what you're doing. They can see your fingernails. They can see the appearance of you. Whether you're dirty, whether you got sweat around your collar, you're dripping in the food. They can see everything. So there's no need to excite a customer and make them think, well, yeah, I buy it. They go home and they don't eat it, and then they never come back again.
Yeah.
So you don't want a customer that's not going to be a repeat customer. That's why it's so important to do things like this for the school, because I can get youngsters, 10, 11 years old, and if I'm going to be here, and they're going to be here for sure, if their parents are here, I can raise them up knowing the quality of food and the type of food that I'm serving. And therefore, when they decide where they're going to go to eat that evening or that afternoon or the next day or 4th of July or whatnot, they say, well, I like Hiram's. Let's go up there.
Yeah.
You know, it's never no doubt.
Yeah, they'll keep you in mind there.
Yeah. So, you know, it's good for that, you know.
Yeah, good. I'm glad that the project helps you out a bit, too, because, you know, you've spent a lot of time in the school's helping us out there, too. So, you know, it comes back
to the school. It's a big help because that one teacher, that last school, I don't know. Flabbergasted because she came out and she had a stack of letters and the amount of letters, the magnitude of what she had in her hand, I never had seen, you know, here. I mean, you know, I was going on a catering and someone coming up for seconds, it might be a line of 50 or 60 people coming up for seconds, but each one of them, whether they're sincere about it or not, they're telling you how good your food was. It could be that they just was hungry. See, but when someone put it in writing, there's no doubt about that.
That's great. That's good.
That's, you know, the way that I analyze it.
Yeah. You do most of your trade just by word of mouth, right? You don't really have any advertising, or very little.
Other than just the smaller newspapers, like the Mandarin News and TV Facts. And just this month alone, I went in two different areas of TV Facts because my wife is from the west side, or north side. She's over on, her parents live over on West 16th, somewhere like over there. And they get that north side shop when they get the north side TV Facts. Well, I have been telling them for years, that, you know, I've been advertising, they never had seen it. So her sister was a wedding that I catered on Saturday. And all those people was happy. Every one of them was happy. I didn't get one complaint out of them. And so I said, well, maybe I'll go in on this side just this time while it's fresh in those people's minds. There's a couple of 200 or 300 people there. And those 200 or 300 done told somebody. And if they happen to see that name in that shop or that TV Facts, well, that might mean some business for me. It's a long way to come, but two people pay for the ad. Mm-hmm. Because I've been constant with the ad and the lady giving me good prices. The same prices I was getting 3-4 years ago, she's still maintaining those prices. That's in my advertising. So thereby, I use the smaller papers, the smaller circulation of papers. Sometimes I use the Lebanese Star. Sometimes I use the Entertainer. Sometimes the Mandarin News. The TV Facts is the biggest advertisement other than Yellow Pages that I have. The biggest.
But a lot of your thing comes just kind of from word of mouth, too.
Word of mouth is the biggest advertisement I'm going to ever have, I know. Uh-huh. Because I'm not going to kick out the money for big advertisement campaigns like, you know, other guys do.
Yeah.
We tried one of the cable vision channels, channel 15 or 17, one of the local cable vision channels, on TV one time. It was just before the Florida-Georgia game. We was advertising tailgate parties and, you know, gatherings from 12 to 20 could eat out of this and that and other for a set amount. And it didn't go so well for me. I didn't get the response that I thought I should have. And it was my negotiating with my father, hammering out this deal to get him to give me the go-ahead. And then when it was a flop, I know I was going to never live that night. So, you know, I didn't never, you know, get up enough nerve to ask him.
Let's see. After you had started building Pits, how did your business get established here with the takeout and then also for doing catering parties? Because you didn't really, the plan wasn't really so much to make a business out of it, right?
Well, you just discussed it. Word of mouth was it.
Oh, I see.
Because we had no place to go so far as a business. Money was low. We had stuck everything in the building of Pits and still maintained things at the house like utilities and food and stuff like that.
Oh, I see.
And money was getting low and we had no place to go. So we went up to one of the local hardware stores, which is changed hands now. It was Flynn's Ace Hardware, now it's Hagen's Hardware. Yeah. But Mr. Flynn owned the hardware store. He had one of the first stores here in Manhattan, period. Yeah. His hardware store was the first store. And it was right around the corner from our house. His store was on the corner of Loretta and Flynn Road. And Flynn Road crosses Orange Pickle. My father worked for him as a little boy. Now, his son, Ronnie, old man Flynn was the guy that owned the store, but Ronnie Flynn took it over. Well, we was passing there, coming the back way down Westbury Road, coming down to make a left on San Jose, and he seen it. So we immediately hammered out a deal with him to park on the corner of his store and feed his family, which was only five of them. And we fed his family, and we would come there Friday and Saturday and Sunday. We get there, most of the time we would come out and bring the pit. And we had a converted bus that we used to use. It was a camper, but we converted it even further by taking out one of the beds and putting in a freezer, a generator, and a stove.
Awesome.
With a fan over and everything. And that's a different department of the health department. These guys that handle RVs or catering vehicles, like you see around at the shipyards, you see the catering trucks going around. But that's a different department than someone that would have a storage or have a permanent, you know, restaurant or takeout. And so it was a hassle because there was another barbecue here in Mandarin. We was right down the road from them, and she was walking and squalling over to the health department that we wasn't legit and we didn't have no license. We was operating on a temporary permit. And word of mouth wouldn't let them close us. I mean, the response, people from the neighborhood, you know, the health department would come out and they would do field surveys and they would talk to people, no, don't do nothing with that guy. He got wonderful food, it's beautiful, he never got sick, ain't nothing. You know, it's just good food and you keep him operating. But we left there during the time that Flynn was about to sell his store, which he sold his store recently, about 4 years ago. And we left there during the early stages of negotiating with him selling his store. And we went up to it used to be a black man, his name was Johnson, Mr. Ecker Johnson. Mr. Ecker Johnson had a teen center and laundromat, which was, it was the only black-owned laundromat ever been in this neighborhood. No other black ever owned a washing mat, we call it. It was a corn-operated laundry, and he had pool tables and a little teen center next door. We had a nice barbecue pit in there. So we went and we parked in front of that building, and we must have stayed there for a year or two. Matter of fact, we had got there so long, we stayed there so long until it was just like we was a squad. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would leave the camper and the pit there, and we just come back there, you know, Friday morning. And what we would do, we would just come on Friday morning, and we'd build a fire, and we'd start anew. Bring fresh products with that freezer. It was operating, but we still had electric current in the old building. So we would pull juice down, save the generator, save the noise, and we'd go on like that. From there, we came here. And there was no more after that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we were talking about getting the start there, and then after that, you've opened up here. Have most of your customers been black, or has it been kind of integrated?
It's just the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
Just opposite. Have you ever went over on 20th Street where the guys sell crabs?
Oh yeah.
You see them sometimes, they had the crabs holding them out like that.
Yeah.
When we first started, we was worse than that. We would take the fault. Mm-hmm. Fresh off the grill, we would have a slab of ribs and holding it side the road there, right around 4:30 or 5 o'clock when everybody's coming through. Mm-hmm. And that's how we was doing our business. Mm-hmm. And we gave away a lot. We used to give away so much during those times. I remember one time in particular, our biggest business was turkeys. We had one contract with doing turkeys for a company called Mesquite Wood Incorporated. And that company would supply us with the fresh turkeys, and we would cook them. Mm-hmm. And from that, we started doing turkey business from the Mandarin Supermarket. And Mandarin Supermarket was hand in hand with us. And what they would do, they would supply us with turkeys, and we would cook them for $7, and they would sell them. And I can't remember, I think it was more money involved. I think another $3 was involved whenever they sold a turkey, because they had to deal with spoilage and stuff too. And so we understanding that, and that's where our price came from on the turkeys. Because, we was using one of those pits then, just like the pits that's in Winn-Dixie and Publix and stuff. The name of them is Southern Pride. Stainless steel unit with a rotisserie inside of it. And it cooks on gas, but it fires on wood. It fires on gas and cooks on wood. But we were cheated. We would be cooking on wood and gas also. See, we turn the gas on and let the wood burn. And be cooking on gas and wood.
Oh, yeah.
Just to put the smoke in. We never use any liquid smoke, MSG, or none of that stuff. No, just regular raw, dry seasoning. Salt, pepper, lemon peel, garlic powder, onion powder, food colorings and stuff like that. That's the only thing we use. We never use nothing that we know might cause cancer. Okay? But anyway, getting back to the story. From there, I was saying that I remember this one time when we were smoking turkeys, which that was our specialty. That's the only contract you had. We were smoking turkeys, and this lady thought she was going to get a turkey. She never ordered it. They ran out of turkeys in this neighborhood. She couldn't find a turkey nowhere. And this was Christmas Eve. She had to have a turkey. And we had three turkeys for our, you know, family, our personal use. And one of those turkeys of the three was going to my grandmother. And the other one was going to be our house. Our intermediate family was going to get one. My grandmother was going to get the other one. And the other one was just going to be a standby. That lady came up and she said, it don't matter what the cost is. She said, I'll pay. She said, I'll give you cash money. I got to have a turkey. This turkey must have weighed 30 pounds and she picked from the three of them. From the three turkeys that she had to choose from, she picked the biggest, which must have weighed about 30 pounds. And she gave us, we was charging her $25 for that turkey. She gave me $60 and gave me a $12 tip for that turkey. And she wouldn't let me give it back to her. And right now, that lady, and I'm embarrassed and I can't remember her name, but she's a real good customer. And right now, she comes in all the time. You know, she comes in all the time. I know her name. Her name is Miss Dr. Phillips, because her husband is an anesthesiologist. And she's a Phillips, and she's a big, robust woman. I hope she don't hit this tape.
That's
she must be 6'1 or 6'2. And she's built like an Amazon. She's a big woman. She comes in all the time. She's still pleased with that, and me and her chuckle about that every Christmas now. It's been 9 years since that happened. She come in every Christmas Eve. She say, I'm going to get my turkey early. You know, she always remember that.
Yeah.
And those kind of things make me feel good inside.
Yeah.
You feel real good inside and know that you got a one-to-one relationship with your customers that you can say, well, Ms. Phillips, can I get you so-and-so and so, or can I do this for you? Can I do that for you? It makes you feel good inside because I don't know the number of the clientele that we have now so far as the regulars. I don't know how many it is. But I do know when different ones or twos or whatever come in, that I know their faces. All of them names I can't remember because all of them don't have the special stories like that I could tell. But I remember their faces, and they can say, Bubba, they remember me. I can't remember them all the time. But I know their face, you know, and I know, you know, how I come about knowing them. I can remember that. I can remember why they come in. Or like, for instance, this guy came in one time. He got some collard greens. He confessed to me that he didn't eat the plate for 2 days. It was 2 days before he ate it. It was wrapped with clear wrap. He didn't refrigerate it, but when he ate it, the only thing was bad on it was the collards. He said the collards was bad. I didn't change words with him. I gave him the largest container of collards that we had. I said, he's a fresh cook, you can have these. He tried to pay me, I wouldn't let him. And from then on, he'd been trying to find some kind of way that he could get to me to pay me for those same collards. And every time he tried, and this done went on for years too. Every time he tried to give me something, I said, nah, you don't owe me that. Yeah. I said, well, you remember you did me a favor one time. I remember, but that's all right. You know, you the one came and told me. You voiced your opinion about a complaint, and I felt all right. Me and you both can live in the same neighborhood. We ain't got to sleep uneasy because we happy with each other. And we happy with the service that I'm giving you, and I'm happy with the service that you're giving me. And that makes for good business. I don't know if that's something that they teach in college. I don't know if that's some kind of course that they teach you. You know, at Hilton Head or something like that when they're giving lectures or something like that. But I do know it worked.
Yeah.
You know, if you give somebody something, or you make good on something that's not right or not totally 100% up to par, people appreciate that because there's no time that you can go on a McDonald's or Wendy's or something like that and get a replacement on a hamburger without nothing. You can't go in there without a hamburger and say this hamburger wasn't right and get another one.
Yeah.
They ain't gonna hear that. Where's the hamburger? That's the first thing you want to know. See, I didn't change words with him. I just said, okay. Yeah. You know, I gave him another large container of collard greens and I said, he's right.
Yeah.
You know.
What are some of the different types of foods that you serve there? You do all the barbecue
ribs. All fresh vegetables. Like I mentioned earlier, we got shrimp rice, sausage and rice, the pork and rice, the chicken and rice. Those are the full rice that we usually use all the time. We got the collard greens. That's every day we got to have collards, fresh collards every day. We use green beans. We use limas. We'll make cornbread stuffing for occasions. 4th of July, I'll have some. Thanksgiving, Christmas, I'll have some. Black-eyed peas we have. Cornbread. There's usually 5 meats there. There's beef ribs and pork ribs, sliced beef, sliced pork, and chicken. Those are the 5 meats. Now, although we specialize in turkeys, a turkey will dry out quick. You can't keep the moisture in a turkey. And keep the temperature up. Now, the health department is going to require that you serve the food at a certain temperature. If the temperature falls or increases, it causes the food itself to deteriorate. It'll either tear apart from too much heat, from steam or too much heat, or it'll spoil from being too low. So turkey is a bad thing to keep. Now, to get by that, a lot of suppliers are starting to make a turkey that's been made from the whole turkey, but it's made like a loaf. It's like a bologna or something. And they make it, that's not real turkey, because it might have pork in it. It might have chicken parts in it. It might have everything that's a meat, you know, been boiled down and gelled into a loaf like a cheese.
That's,
you know, like you make hog head cheese. That's about like it's made.
Yeah.
You know, it's all a gristle and bone part and everything. Now that'll keep. That won't spoil, and you maintain the temperature. It won't deteriorate. It won't tear apart. It won't shrink. That'll keep. But it's just not real. Now, so on the turkeys, although that's a specialty, we just cook those on Thanksgiving, 4th of July, Christmas, New Year's. We'll have them to serve then, when they're going to move. But during the everyday work week, we won't have them.
Yeah, otherwise you just smoke them on special order and that kind of thing.
And we do any kind of specialty cooking. I've cooked everything from bear to alligator on that pit.
Oh, really?
For others.
Uh-huh.
And during hunting season, it's hectic. I mean, guys go on... We have to get here early. Hunters go to hunt early. They might be out in the woods that night and start first daybreak, before daybreak, hunting. So they lot will be coming out of the woods 10 or 10:30, coming out of the woods. They might field strip, or what they call field stripping is when you take the innards out of an animal in the woods and skin him out. Well, they might cut the whole animal up in the woods, bring it to you, they want you to wash it and cook it, and they're going back hunting and pick it up later. See, so it's a lot of specialty cooking where you can make some real serious money, you know, doing it for others. You know, someone come in, for instance, and they ask you, say, I got a deer ham. How much you charge me to smoke it? I say, how big is it? I don't know. I just killed him. You know, well, you don't know how big it is. Let me see it. Well, I'm sighting it. I don't know how big it is, how much it weigh. I ain't weighing it. I don't know. It's worth $4 or $5 to me. Okay. They come back. They might give me $10, $20. They just slip that to me. I thank him, you know. Because the first thing I do when they get here, I say, taste it, you know. Because you done turned me loose on it, and I season it like I want it, like I would like it. But you might not like it. Taste it. They taste it, and if it tastes good, they always tip you better, you know. Mm-hmm. So who amongst men walking around with 7 $1 bills in their pocket at one time? Not too many.
Yeah.
They give you 5 and 2 ones. They want to keep their ones. Yeah. They might have kids that need a dollar for lunch the next day or anything. To keep from shorting himself on the chain or having to go back to a little champ or something to make change or going to a bank or what have you, they give you a 10. Oh, forget it. It's good. I like it. You know, that's a tip. That's a good tip.
Yeah.
And you figure if 10 people come in and give you $3 tip, that's $30 you made.
Yeah.
See?
That's
so
pretty business.
You know, so that was my angle to make extra money for me when my father couldn't afford to pay me what I was worth. He couldn't afford to pay me. He said, well, okay, I'll give you all the specialty cooking. I won't give you my turkey money, but I'll give you all the specialty cooking. If somebody come in with an alligator tail or a piece of bear meat, a deer, whatever, you cook it. If you got some doubt about how to season it or what goes good with that meat or what tastes good on it, ask. And I'll tell you, and you still keep the money. All I want you to do is just maintain me a 400 or 500 degree temperature in there all day long. Because you don't never know when someone's going to come in and they want something rush cooked. They got a turkey. Can you cook this turkey in 3 hours? You know? Mm-hmm. It's just a turkey breast. We're going to have this for dinner. I just picked up at the store and that smoke smells so good.
Yeah.
I thought I'd let you cook it for me.
Uh-huh.
This kind of thing happened.
Uh-huh.
And you never know when it's going to happen. If you got a little 150 to 200 degree temperature in like Fat Boys or Woodies or something like that, you can't take it on. Well, with those guys, they got gas. Just like I say, the Southern Prize, they got gas. There's nothing to do but to turn the gas up. But what you're cooking on wood, you can't get that temperature like that. The wood got to burn the coals before your meat gonna smoke to the proper complexion, or it'll be too dark, or it'll be too light, and you don't want that. Because if it's too light, one would think that it's not done, even if it is. If it's too dark, they'll think it's burnt, even if it's not. See? So it's got to be like it's got to be. You can't change that part.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the part you can't change.
Yeah.
Now, I have found ways of cheating so far as building fires. Like, you helped me that day. We use all dry wood, and we put the food right on there, the meat right on there. And the complexion was just like it would be if I had used green wood and let it burn to a coal. Mm. Why? Because the wood... It's no nutrients or nothing like that involved to get it, but the wood is the life is gone of it. It's seasoned, you know, and a seasoned wood will burn like a chip, like a piece of paper, and that's how we can cheat. That's how come I keep so much dry wood around.
That's
because a lot of time the temperature will be down when someone come in and want to know if I can't do something. I can throw dry wood in there and put the fan on like a bellows or something and just blow that air to it, and the oxygen gonna bring that temperature up like that. It's just that simple. My daddy didn't know that trick, and he would hate to see me not have that 400 or 500. Just put it in there. It's my wood. Just put it in there. It's my pit. It's my wood. Put it in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It ain't no matter if it burn it up. I'm cooking on 15 cents a day. He would always say it, you know. And
uh-huh.
I got drilled with that. But still, yet I find myself becoming lazy or tired or fatigued or some type, and I let the temperature drop.
Yeah.
And when that happens and someone come in, it's always just as soon as that temperature drop below cooking temperature. And we think of cooking temperature as being 200 or better. Anything less than that, you're smoking. Because you smoke meat. When my great-grandfather had a smokehouse and he would smoke hams, 123 degrees was the temperature that you had to have in that. And you had to maintain that in the smokehouse constantly. I think it was 23, 25 days or something like that. I smoked like a Virginia cured ham, and we would smoke hams, and that's how he had to do it. I can remember him taking garbage pails and putting hams down in those garbage pails and soaking them in some kind of salt solution that he used. And out of that same solution, he would take a hypodermic needle and he would draw up some of it, and he would stick it as close to the bone of that animal as he could, and he would inject that fluid down in there. And when it smoked, it cured from the outside in, but the juices from the inside out kept it from spoiling. Because once you leather is a technique that you use when you're smoking that hardens the outside of the meat, whether it's the rind of a hog or whether it's just the skin of a piece of beef, the leathering technique from the smoke, it hardens that, it crushes it, you put a coating on it that hardens it. Therefore, your meat could spoil from the inside out, and that hard part will be done, and the rest of that meat will just slide right off the bone because it'll be so slimy, it'll be rotting. And that's a problem that most of your smokehouses had to deal with long before they start smoking meat chemically.
Yeah.
And that's probably why, or one of the reasons why, that meat is being smoked chemically rather than by smoke nowadays. And in weighing all these things is one of the reasons that we still do it the old-fashioned way. Because we know what we're doing. We know the direction that we got to take. We know the shortfalls. We know the problems that we're looking for. You know, we ain't got no business getting into those kind of problems because we know that that's there. You know, it's there. So we got to get into it. See?
Could you give me kind of the step-by-step way that you go about, say, preparing a slab of ribs? Kind of just from start to finish there.
Okay, let me give you two.
Okay.
One, if I'm preparing a slab of ribs for just me and you home or something like that, first thing I would do, I take that slab of ribs and wrap with the brisket end of it. It's a flap of meat that overhangs there that came off of the bacon.
Mm-hmm.
I take that and I cut it right up under there. And then I take that skin and I pull it out. Usually, a dry cloth will hold that skin to keep it from, you know, pulling and sliding in your hand. I take that skin out. Why? Because that skin, it stops your seasoning from going into the meat. So you can put your seasoning on that skin and you take the hose and you can wash it off.
That's it,
see? That skin makes the meat where it's the same on both sides. is fresh on both sides. There's nothing but protecting the meat itself. And it's also a tender product when you do it that way. Then I season it. I use a homemade barbecue spice that we mix up with paprika and red pepper and salt and black pepper. And we use a lot of white pepper too. White pepper brings out the freshness in food and it hides the pepper. Mm. You won't see it, but you have the same heat when you eat to it. So we use a lot of that. Then I would cook that slab of ribs, not on direct heat, but away from the direct heat, and probably around 250. Let it cook slow. Now, when I'm doing it for the masses, I take those ribs, I take them off, I pull what fat that's visible, not the skin, the fat, pull that off or cut it off. I throw it into fire to fuel the fire, get the fire hot, because I need the same temperature even while the dough. So I throw it in there and let it fuel that fire where I can maintain the same temperature. Then I wash it, and I don't put no seasoning on the meat itself for two reasons. One is everybody can eat seasoning. I might have a customer that's a diabetic, and not knowing that I'm seasoning the meat, I give it to them, it could cause them, you know, going into a diabetic coma or whatnot. Or two pieces of meat is being packed together when we maintain it after it's been done. We put them in bus pans and we put it in the warmer to maintain the temperature. And dry seasoning can cause spoilage. It can cause the meat to spoil. So therefore, I can't season it like I would if I was going to a party. I could season it because I know whatever that I'm putting on, I'm planning on using it. See, so I can season it. But I can't serve it in the shop because it could cause spoilage or it could cause someone to get sick and we don't want that. So thereby not seasoning the meat, I season the fire. I put the seasoning in and around the fire. Onion, salt, pepper, everything right in the fire. And then I take a water hose and I spray that fire. When that water that's hitting the fire turns into steam, and being in that tank, it don't allow all the smoke to get out at one time. That smoke just rotates around in that tank. And the steam and the seasoned steam juices just goes and rotates around in that meat and it's seasoned. And it's not a direct seasoning, but it's got a taste to it. And to be honest with you, I have put a piece of meat on with no season and one like I'm telling you to cook it, and it's a difference in the taste. So I know it works.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
The reason I keep doing it is not just to throw away seasoning. It works.
Yeah.
No season.
That's it. How long are you cooking it inside the cooker there?
Well, what I do, if we come in fresh in the morning and say there's the bulk meat, we can serve the next day. Pork and beef is cooked anywhere from 5 to 30 pounds at a time. And it might just be one piece or it might be in several pieces, 2 or 3 pieces, but it's gonna be that amount for the days, you know, running. Now, like I said, my father, he always wanted us to maintain a 400 to 500 degree temperature all the time. So thereby maintaining that temperature, I can cook a slab of ribs or say a 2.5 pound chicken in 17 to 30 minutes.
Wow, that's real fast.
That's fast. And what it does, that temperature, it brings the temperature up on a thawed piece of meat so fast until the meat are plump. When the meat plumps to the highest thickness that it's gonna plump, it's time to take it off. You want to take it off by hand if you can. If not, use the fork in such a way that you go up under the meat and not pierce it, because it's plump. That's juices. As soon as you pierce it, the juices will run out. But if you don't pierce it and you put two pieces of meat together, it increases at least 10, 15 degrees in temperature, and it'll cook on off. It'll make a customer think that the ribs have been pre-balled, parboiled. That's the texture that you get from it by doing it that way. So it works. It tenderizes the meat because when it plumps and the gristle and fat and stuff that's on the bone it's then tearing and it relaxes around that bone, and therefore the meat will slide right off the bone.
It's just like
you had parboiled it or steamed.
Yeah.
So it works real nice for us.
Uh-huh. When I was watching you cook a couple months ago, you had a pretty interesting technique called politicking. Can you tell me about that?
Politicking is a technique that we use for what we call dragging customers off the road. It's doing me good because, like I say, we season our fire. In politicking, it's like you open the fire and you just spray water all over it. And you put an onion in there. But you don't put it in the fire to season the meat because it might be overseasoned. You put it on the grill itself and let the fire blaze up through it. And then just use the water to take it on out across the road. Now, depending on the direction of the wind here at the shop, I say, depending on the direction of the wind, we can politic and say right now it's 20 minutes after 5. Okay, everybody got off 5 o'clock. I'll be coming through him in the next 10, 20 minutes. They'll be coming through him. Now, right now, if I was to open the pit up, which you can smell it now. You smell the smoke, the direction of the wind. Right now, if I was to open that pit up and throw an onion on there and spray it down real good, well, then these people, they've been working all day. They done had one lunch at 12 o'clock. Unless they cheated on their job, they had one lunch. They're hungry. These people are hungry. Let me stop right there. Have you ever been to the fair and seen these guys that are cooking sausage, hot dogs, and corn dogs and stuff? Have you ever noticed they have more onions on their grill than they have sausage? They sell a sausage, they sell just a little bit of onion with it. Why they got the onion? It's politics. They let you smell it. Ooh, that smells good. You're hungry when you get to the fair. You've been ripping and running trying to get there at the right time, and you're hungry, and these onions and hot dogs and stuff, you know it's going to give you gas and heartburn and stuff, but you're hungry, and those onions going to drag you right on over there.
Oh, yeah.
And you find yourself buying cotton candy and corn dogs and hot dogs and sausage dogs and stuff because of those onions.
Yeah.
Valdez is one of the best at it. A Valdez onion, we can throw in our pit hole, and like I said, depending on the direction of the wind, we can just about reach out on the road with the smoke and say, come in.
Yeah, it really drags people
it
in.
It drags them in. So that's another thing I was trial and error.
Yeah.
We were sitting around the first time that came about. We were sitting around, and that's where we got it from the fair. Because, you know, my daddy said, well, look at those guys be selling them damn hot dogs and stuff over there. I mean, you know a hot dog or a sausage dog, what it tastes like at 8 o'clock at night, you know. So we started using the technique, and we was lazing around. Had gotten lazy because we hadn't made good money on this particular day that I'm thinking about. And we was lazing around, and my dad said, shoot, why do y'all throw onion in that damn fire? Just like that. And we did, and sprayed water on it, and people were coming in and coming in until the smell of that onion was gone.
Uh-huh.
And there's a technique we use for sterilizing our pit. We try not to use no chemicals. Not try. We don't use no chemicals on our pit. Not on the cooking surface itself. None. Mm-hmm. Now we might use chemicals on the outside of the pit to get grease or something like that off. But on the inside of that pit, we don't use none of that. And the way we go about sterilizing it is we'll run the temperature up anywhere from 1,000 to 1,600 degrees. And we do that by taking the newspaper that we get dropped out there every day in boxes from the supply room. Excuse me. And we use those boxes, and we use the drafting techniques that we've learned over the years to prop the doors up on the pits, and we'll burn the grease off the pits, the doors, the grates, the drafting doors, stacks, everything. We'll burn all the grease out, and it'd be so thick that you wouldn't even notice it. The door might get heavy on you. You might find yourself getting tendonitis in the shoulder just lifting it. And you say, it's time to sterilize this pit. And when you burn it, it'll be a sheet of grease come off the doors about a quarter inch thick at least.
Huh.
And it come off the doors, you can just take a regular garden hoe or a shovel or something and just scrape it, and the whole thing will come off in a sheet.
Yeah.
And the grates and doors and stacks and everything in that pit will be snow white.
Hmm.
And you know when you see it that it can't be no cleaner than that.
Yeah.
I mean, the grates just go back to bare root, just like they was when you first put them in there.
Uh-huh.
When you first got them from the shipyard, that's just how they look. They look like that.
Uh-huh.
And we have some heat distortion, you know, from the heat. You know, it'll warp or distort the metal to where it'll bend, and it'll sink in, and it'll look bad after a while. And the pit is designed in such a way the grates come out. One man can take all the grates out, every one of them by itself. and actually get down in there and stand in there with a shovel and shovel all the grease and stuff out the bottom of it and actually sterilize it. And it's just about like when you work hard all day and you got a body odor, you don't know how bad you smell until you take a shower and you take those dirty clothes back to your laundry hamper. Mm-hmm. See? So it's the same with that pit. You don't know how bad it's smelling until you actually burn it out. And then you smell that grease, and that bad grease that's starting to spoil in the bottom of it, and it starts smelling. When you burn that off, there's nothing but freshness. Mm-hmm. And that technique also drags customers in. Mm-hmm. If it's no more than just being inquisitive about what was the big fight for, yeah, they come in.
Yeah.
The day after we burned out in 86.
The day your after restaurant burned out?
In 86. It was December the 7th that we burned out. It was on a Sunday. I know that for a fact because my daddy went in the hospital on the 8th. It was the next day. Now, the day we burned out, that night we burned out, it was thousands of people passing, seeing it burning. A lot of them stopped. A lot of them felt close enough that they could come up and converse with you while it was burning. The next day, just to show you just how inquisitive people are, the next day, I took the smaller pit that we got out there and I tore the balance of the building down. Got all the stuff out of it that what could be savage and what couldn't be savage, I threw away. I burnt the rest of the building in the pit. And I had all the grease out and I just had the fire in there and we just throwing the stuff in. I had to sell food. People come up, oh, I know you got something over there, cook, please. I'm hungry, man, I want something. And I had to sell food. We had to go back to the old school, start operating out the bus again, call the health department, they didn't come out. I told them what the situation was. They say, so be it, go ahead, we'll get Mr. Green out. Mr. Green was the field inspector for the RVs and whatnot that do the catering of vehicles. And he never came out. By the time he came out, we was back in another building. But we stayed closed one day. After the burnout, that was the day I cleaned up, and I even actually sold food that day. I had to. They wouldn't let me get by.
So your big plan is to build a new restaurant then?
Yeah, got to. It's just too much business being lost. We had 35, 40 seats in there. And during lunchtime, if you could look over and you see 40 people out there, you know your business. You know what you can do the next day. You know what you could afford to buy. You know what you couldn't. And it's a plus to be able to sit somebody down as opposed to them getting a takeout and going home. A lot of people go out to eat because they want to eat out. They don't want to take out to go home. They're tired of home. They don't want to see this house no more. It's killing them. They don't want to see it, so they come out to eat. And whether it's just a cozy little restaurant on the side of the road or whether it's just a breezy spoon on the side of the road, if that's what they want to do, then you should give them the opportunity, you know, to be afforded them the opportunity to be able to do it.
Yeah. But you're doing pretty well with parties right now, catering
Catering.
How many would you do a year, about?
My goal this year is going to be 30. And right now I'm just above schedule on that. Mm. Because I didn't start counting until the 8th of February is when I started counting. And it's just June, just about July now. And I must have did 20 parties in the last 3 months. And I've been ripping and running. What I've been trying to do, I've been trying to handle my customers like a real professional. I've been trying to tell them, no, you don't want to party on Saturday. Nobody gonna be there. Everybody gonna be down to Harbor Masters, or they gonna be down to the River Walk or to the Landing or somewhere. They trying to kick it everywhere else, you know, and they ain't gonna wanna show up. What you wanna do, you wanna have your party on Monday. You wanna have it on Tuesday. And I've been trying to book the weekdays. I accomplish a lot by doing that. I can disguise a lot of what I'm making on the parties. Because people just standing around gazing at you and seeing what you're doing. I don't really want that. We had 2 break-ins already. I don't want someone to come in, one of the girls, and rob you or something like that on a Saturday when you're thinking you're making a mint, and you're not. So I try to change those parties to the weekdays that I can. And what I do, I make the weekends available for the ones that I can't. See what I'm saying? If someone call in and they say, I want a party on July 4th, you know, okay, I say, well, I can't do it. I got 3 parties booked already. I can't do it. But if I can change 2 of those parties to a weekday, then I can afford myself the time to be able to do that weekend party. And most of my customers, like I say, I'm on a first name basis, or I'm on a sight to face basis with them where I know them and they know me. And they'll listen to what I say. and it do make sense to them.
Yeah.
You know, if I can give them a, if I can theorize to them what makes sense, and it's gonna be good for them. If they can do this, they'll bend over backwards to do it. Especially if they think it's helping me. See, so I can get more parties in. Whereas my father was only doing parties Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I do parties Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So I can get more into 1 week. I get more production out of catering than twice as much as we was getting all the time.
Most of your parties are people who have like hardware or business stores that are opening up, or company picnics and things along that line, right?
No. I get a lot of company parties.
Awesome.
Topping off parties and safety parties are big now.
And what?
Safety parties.
What's that?
Companies give a safety party, or they give some kind of reward to their employees for being safe-free on a job site.
Yes, sir.
For instance, on the concrete pumping company out here, Seco, out on 115, working for the Haskell company out there. They have one every 19 days. I did a safety party for Southern Railway. They have one once a year. If they go safe-free. Now, if there's some injury or accidents on the job, well, then they won't get a safety party. It's an incentive for the workers to try their best to maintain and exercise proper safety procedures and techniques on the job. They all learn them and they know them, but actually putting it into use is another thing.
Plus, you get some political parties too, right?